Thank you, Judge Kavanaugh, and may it please the court. In every case in which the Supreme Court or this court has upheld a provision of the 1992 Cable Act against a First Amendment challenge, the court has construed the statute in question as a market regulation that has only an incidental effect on speech. That is not how the FCC asks this court to construe Section 616 today. On the government's view, Section 616 has nothing to do with bottleneck power, monopoly power, market power, or any of those usual characteristics that have been the hallmark of the court, of the court's earlier cases.
Counsel, you may not be, but we are obliged to address the statutory issues first.
And I was going to those, Judge Williams. What the government says is not what the statute says. I started with a backdrop of the First Amendment because if there were any issue as to the possible ambiguity or meaning of the statutory language, it would have to be considered against the backdrop of the avoidance doctrine. But the statute, quite simply, is a two-barreled statute. It has a requirement of an unreasonable restraint on fair competition in addition to a discrimination component. What the Commission has done in this case is to read the unreasonable restraint out of the statute altogether by positing that broader carriage will bring with it financial benefits that means that the claimant is being restrained, which of course will be true in every carriage complaint. Our view is quite different. It is that in light of the statutory background that existed in 1992 and the long tradition of competition regulation of in this country, which was the primary concern that Congress had in the Act, that the phrase unreasonable restraint has to be examined in light of the bottleneck controls that concerned Congress in 1992.
Examine in light of it, but that would be different from saying it has to identically track the bottleneck theory.
Judge Williams, I think I can anticipate cases in which I would not necessarily contend that the essential facilities doctrine would be the first and last step of the analysis under the statute. And it is possible that the government, based on some proof of congressional intent, could formulate some market-based theory that would allow, you know, the regulation of what the cable company is doing in a specific context. My basic problem with the Commission's approach here is that the Commission has completely escaped the central focus of the 1992 Act.
It's moved the adverb unreasonably from one part of the statute to another.
And by doing so has essentially nullified the concern of competition that Congress had. If you look at the statement of policy in the statute, which is section 2B of the statute, Congress expressly stated at 2B5 that it was concerned about undue market power that cable companies would exercise vis-a-vis programmers. And it also stated in 2B2 that it expected that the Commission would rely on the market to the maximum extent feasible. In a context in which Congress was surely aware that it was regulating or attempting to regulate at least some exercises of editorial discretion, which this Court and the Supreme Court both have found is protected by the First Amendment, it is certainly quite appropriate to conclude that Congress intended the statute to be applied sensitively to market failures or some market-based theory that could advance congressional desire for a competitive market, not simply as a discrimination statute as the Commission reads it, which turns on the comparison of the content of the networks in question, and which is, by doing so, becomes a direct invasion of the editorial function. If I could put this in another way, Judge Williams, I have no doubt that if Congress were to pass a statute saying that a First Amendment entity is required to give preference to the speech of non-affiliates of its own over its own speech, that would be a clear violation of the First Amendment. As a matter of hardcore constitutional right, I am entitled to prefer my own speech over that of another's. Congress may invade that incidentally under the court's cases if there is a greater goal that is unrelated to the suppression of ideas. And once you have that as a starting point, then you can talk about what types of evidence might bear on the ultimate question of discrimination. Though that question itself, I would submit, has to be sensitively considered in light of the need to give a berth to the exercise of editorial discretion by First Amendment entities. For example, in the MASN case, which went to the Fourth Circuit, the commission itself turned down a complaint carriage which had been upheld below the commission on the express ground that the claimant had been treated in the same way by every other MVPD, because the commission thought that the evidence of the market as to whether these two entities were similarly situated was the best evidence as to whether indeed there was discrimination. That was the view of the two dissenting commissioners here, but obviously now the commission has changed course and has turned from looking at the market, saying, does this network and this network, are they equally valued by the market, to a straight comparison of the content of the two networks. Again, if I were to posit that this statute, that the affiliation discrimination concept could be applied to the press generally, and I were ready to entertain, for example, the proposition that the New York Times would be required to give employment to freelance writers and to publish them on the front page, someone coming in with a complaint saying, I am as good as the late R.W. Apple, you should put me on the front page. If the statute were permissible at all under any theory, one would think that it would be highly relevant to see whether the freelance writer is published by every other paper in the front page, whether he's acclaimed, et cetera. But if the market evidence were that he is published in Part G of every paper in the country where he's published, next to the used car ads, one might reasonably conclude that this person is no R.W. Apple. And, you know, the last thing one would anticipate as an appropriate governmental response to that statute would be a board of government censors looking at the writing of both and deciding whether, you know, the upstart freelance really has a good insight into the issues of the day. And that's exactly the role that the commission has arrogated to itself here. Now, let me say a little word about what the commission says Congress was concerned about here. The commission says Congress was not really concerned about competition, but about vertical integration simpliciter. Now, of course, in a speech market of this sense, of this sort, what the commission truly is saying is that Congress was concerned about giving non-affiliated speech preference, or at least equal dignity with affiliated speech. And if we don't think that that's content-based, it is at least speaker-based. And as we know from Citizens United and the Arizona versus Bennett case, speaker-based distinctions also carry with them strict scrutiny. Now,
sometimes and sometimes not. I mean, as one whose opinion was rejected in Turner Broadcasting, I'm sensitive to the Supreme
Court. Well, I understand you are. But one of the interesting things about Turner Broadcasting, Judge Williams, is that the court, by a 5-4 vote, was basically indulging the government's theory that what was at issue was electrons and not speech.
Right.
And I suppose one could look at it and say that is not any consideration of speech at all. It's only the medium that matter, and the medium has a separate market that wants to be protected. But again, if Congress in this case were looking at the commercial value of speech only, then it would be a conclusive answer to say that there is no one in the market who think that these networks are in fact comparable, and that includes even the partial owners of Tennis Channel. And again,
the evidence in the record is that all the unaffiliated programmers were put on the sports tier, right? And then the, correct me if I'm wrong, and then the ones with minority interests were put on the intermediate tier, and then golf and versus put on the broadest tier.
I wouldn't say that that was what the evidence in the market is. I believe that's what the commission said. In fact, what the evidence is in the record with specific reference to the other affiliated sports networks is that the broader carriage came about by the demands of the NBA and Major League Baseball. Mm-hmm. And it's just a question of the strength of the bargaining power. If you want the out-of-town games, you have to agree to the broader carriage. If Tennis Channel had that same type of appeal and or viewed as a similar form of must-have programming, surely would have acquired that from other MVPDs in the market, but obviously it does not. It is also
isn't the question on this point, this is separate from your obviously unreasonable restraint argument, but on the discrimination point, isn't the question what would Comcast have done had it owned the Tennis Channel? And the conclusion the commission draws is, well, if they had owned the Tennis Channel, they presumably would have treated it like the Golf Channel, and because they didn't own the Tennis Channel, they treated it differently, which is affiliate.
But I know that actually we know from the record that that's not true, Judge Kavanaugh, because, you know, the record clearly showed that beginning in 2006, Tennis Channel came to Comcast with offers of equity for broader distribution. Under the commission's rule, a 5% attributable interest would have rendered them an affiliate. So they were basically saying, make me your affiliate and give me broad distribution. It is not true that's how it's done. And in addition, it is also true that Comcast carries a number of non-affiliated networks, including sports networks, ESPN, et cetera, in broadly distributed tiers because they do have that sort of market appeal. You know, the issue here is if you look at the test of the market, Tennis Channel has not been able to obtain the level of penetration that it claims Comcast and only Comcast owes to it. And again, if you were looking solely at the discrimination point, Judge Kavanaugh, it is arbitrary for the commission to go from the Mazin case saying that we'll take the evidence of the market and look at how other MVPDs treat the same claimant network, and then turn around here and disregard that on the theory that everybody else follows Comcast. That is a heads-I win and tails you lose theory of agency, the decision maker, because there is no case that the commission can possibly ever be overturned on. I mean, either, you know, they're following the leader or the leader is not following, you know, the rest of the market. Irrational.
Also, just thinking the overview, the way your argument fits together, even if there were discrimination here, your theory on the first part of your argument is that's fine under the statute so long as there's not market power by Comcast, both because of the way the statutory term is.
That is my theory under the statute, Judge Kavanaugh, because it's a double-barrel statute. I actually dispute that there is a discrimination.
I understand that. I just want to make sure I understand.
No. It is absolutely the case.
Your theory on the first part of the argument, Comcast could have an explicit policy, I assume, of dropping all unaffiliated.
Judge Kavanaugh, I make no bones on the proposition that if there is no market power and there is no other non-speech interest that the government can regulate, I am entitled under the First Amendment to like my speech better than yours. Mm-hmm. And unless and until the government comes in with an important governmental interest that is non-speech based and in which it is exercising its proper regulatory authority, I am entitled to do that. On the assumption that there is,
and then your theory is even if you have, even if discrimination is a violation, there isn't enough evidence of discrimination here, right?
Well, I think that the evidence, given the congressional instruction in 2B2 to rely on the market to the maximum extent feasible, that to me is a direction to assess discrimination based on a similarly situated type of analysis that is entirely non-content-based. And if you found that it was appropriate to at least make this first cut, sports, for example, on a speech basis, you would still have a market-based way of looking at the question whether this is in line with the market or outside of the line of the market, which would be, I would submit, the most probative evidence. Is it the most relevant evidence on the subjective motivations? Probably not. But you may also have to consider, in the context of this statute and in the context of a discrimination statute that operates on the exercise of editorial judgment, that judgments about discrimination have to be themselves, apart from the market prong, be made on the basis of the interests that concern Congress, which were market-based.
You could try to answer.
Yeah. Yes, Your Honor.
Can I switch you? This is all moot if there was no timely petition filed, right?
That's right, Your Honor. And under our view, Tennis Channels signed a contract that expressly contemplated that it would be carried on this tier in 2005. Its only theory as to why this suit could be timely is that by 2009, it has achieved such wild success that the terms of the contract ought not to control. Now, if that's true, of course, they also flunked, the market element of 616. But fundamentally, our view of this case is that this is an F1 case under the regulation, Your Honor, that F3, I don't think the commission thinks should be applied in a case in which F1 does apply.
F3, a party is notified, which, as you argue in your brief, can be any time.
Right. I mean, one of the issues about, the fundamental issue on this question, Judge Edwards, is this a statute of limitations or isn't? Because if you read F3, then you can always bring a stale claim by self-exertion. Now, even the commission does not say that. And
they've now added a laches notion, which is interesting. I'll wait to hear from them on that. I'm not sure I understand it. But let me ask you something. In the 1999 reconsideration order, remember it? You got it in your head?
I'm trying desperately at this moment.
it's really helpful to you, so you ought to get it in your head. Where they disclaim, you cite it.
Yes.
They completely disclaimed
changing the meaning of the statute of limitations.
Right.
That is correct.
They subscribe to your view of F3 rather explicitly.
That's
right. Is there any subsequent there? They cite in response weekly a couple of media division.
Now they say themselves that the media bureau is not controlling over
right.
the decisions
so
of the commission.
Right. So the only question I'm asking you is there
anything? No, there is no subsequent action of the commission.
The commission itself,
and
because the 99
correct.
Answers the question about what they intended to do in 94.
That is right. And as we know from State Farm, if they wish to change their view, they have to have an acknowledgement of the change and at least some modicum of an explanation under Fox. They did not offer that here. They instead had some sort of Scarlett O'Hara, we'll worry about that issue in the morning. Here are some latches for you to get you through the night.
Latches was creative. You got to give them that, right?
Well, I mean, I have never contended that my good friends of the commission are not good lawyers. They just happen to be wrong in this case on multiple things. And those include, the meaning of the statute, the fact that this is an entirely unnecessary fight because this case is clearly time-barred, and the fact that if this were not time-barred and the statute actually said and meant what the commission says, it would be one of the most outrageous invasions of, the First Amendment since the Sedition Acts. And I don't think...
But your theory doesn't... You aren't claiming that subsection 3 is, as worded, simply invalid, are you?
No. I'm actually claiming that the commission had given it an established construction in 1999 from which they departed here, that under that established construction, F3 does not apply, and that the only part of the regulation that does apply is one, is F1, under which once Tennis Channel entered into the contract in 2005 with a provision that expressly contemplated the facts about which he now it now complains. And in a world in which the same claim that it now brings was already ripe because Gulf and Versus were...
You're not going the next step. Your brief is a little loose on this, but I don't think you mean to go to the next step. I want to be sure. You're not addressing a situation where the claim of discrimination with respect to which F3 might apply has nothing to do with a dispute over the contract.
No, and I think, you know, I don't know that I can envision enough cases to give you my view as to what I actually think about that, Judge Edwards. But my view of this is that what makes this case simple is that the contract was entered in 2005, and it was like an express contemplation of the contract, and indeed a bargain term that Tennis Channel could be placed exactly where it is now in circumstances when it was already evident that Gulf and Versus were broadly distributed. Under F1, their time to bring that case expired in 2006. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
I please the court. My name is Peter Karangia for the FCC. Judge Edwards, in response to your question about the 1999 order, it's true the order did refer to refusals to negotiate, but it certainly didn't in any way suggest that F3 is limited solely to that. Now, if you read the statute of limitations...
You want me to read you what you said?
I believe it said it refers to refusals to deal, but it didn't say it was limited to that.
An offer to amend an existing contract that has been in effect for more than a year does not reopen the existing contract to complaints that the provisions thereof are discriminatory.
Right. I don't think this...
That, in addition to what else is said there, makes it absolutely clear that your argument, you glibly say in the brief, oh, yeah, that's true, the original regulation said this, but a sentence was removed. Their response was that sentence was removed without any intention to affect this rule. And this rule is absolutely dispositive. It makes sense of 1 and 3. You can't come up at any time, 8, 10 years later, and say, you know what, now we hate the contract.
I agree with that. And the commission did recognize latches, which I'll get to in a minute. But if I could just point out the ramifications of petitioners' reading, what they say is that although the discrimination occurred in 2009, which was when there was a refusal to change the tier of Tennis Channel, nonetheless, Tennis Channel was required to file suit 3 years earlier before the discrimination even occurred. And we submit that's not a reasonable reading. Now, we do have...
First of all, they don't concede there was any discrimination, so they're not making that concession.
Yes, that's a merits argument, I think, Your Honor. I mean...
But you're premising... You're laying a foundation and saying they're conceding something. They're not conceding anything. They're not conceding that point.
I didn't mean to suggest they were conceding discrimination.
I've gone back over this a number of times. The commission itself says, without regard to the claim you might be able to make, you have signed a contract. The contract controls. And if this is essentially about the effects of the contract that you have signed, too bad.
Your Honor.
That's what this says in 99.
I think I understand.
And your only answer, I want to make sure, because I read it over and over again, there's no answer. You just glibly say, let me tell you, and then you can answer me. You glibly say, oh, that's a thing that happened 18 years ago. That's the best they can come up with?
Well,
except the thing 18 years ago is what is still in play.
Our answer, Your Honor, is that if you read subsection 3 as we do, it does not leave an open-ended indefinite statute of limitations because of latches.
Where is latches in the regulation? Because now what you've done is you've put yourself in harm's way on a failure to follow APA procedures if you're going to amend a rule. There's no latches rule in here. This is totally inconsistent with what you did 18 years, what you did originally. Totally inconsistent. Let me finish. If you're going to do it, you got to follow APA procedures. You've also put yourself in harm's way with what Supreme Court said last term in Fox. You can't hold people responsible for things they had no notice of. They had no notice that this was a viable possibility. None. under the existing regulation, because the regulation had never been construed the way you said it is.
With respect, Your Honor, on that point, I think they did have notice in the Masson decision, in the NFL case. It's true they were Bureau decisions, but Section 155C, I believe, specifically states that actions of the Media Bureau or whichever relevant bureau taken on delegated authority have the same force and effect as Commission actions.
Did the Bureau mean to overrule what the Commission said here?
I don't think it meant to overrule anything, because
I don't think so either. They did not have notice.
Well, I would submit they're not inconsistent, Your Honor, because, again, I don't think the 1999 order said that the third prong is limited to situations.
I commend you to another reading of it. Read all of it. The Commission is so, it's so rare that you get something that is so clear. They're absolutely clear what they're saying. It makes good sense, and you understand it makes good sense because you had to come up with laches, which no one had ever thought about before, but you realize the absurdity of saying you can have a one-year bar with a contract is it, and then you said, oh, my God, now we're going to construe three to mean any time it occurs to them they can file? All they have to do is say we want to negotiate, well, we hate what we have. We think we have a different situation now, and if you refuse to, we're going to give you notice, and we start the clock again.
I think laches is a necessary ingredient here.
If you go with a ridiculous interpretation.
Well, I do come back to the fact that I think their interpretation is more ridiculous, Your Honor, because it means that if...
You want one man's view?
this is my submission, Your Honor. If it is the case, and we believe it clearly is, The gist of this complaint was not that the contract itself was unlawful. The gist of the complaint was the post-contract refusal to change the tiering was unlawful. And if that's the case, we submit, by its term, subsection 1 doesn't apply, because that only applies when you're complaining
about the
contract.
They had no obligation under the contract to change the tiering.
They had an obligation, we submit, to exercise their discretion in accordance with the federal statute. And I think it's a general principle of law that...
The statute says they have an obligation to bargain. They bargained. They signed a contract. The contract was lawful. The commission has said they don't have to reopen it.
They never made a waiver argument. I mean, if that's what you're getting at, they never submitted that this can't, and this is a point the commission addresses in footnote 116 of the order, they never claimed that the contractual provision waived their rights to file suit under a federal statute here, Section 616. If I could turn to the merits, Your Honor, I think it's quite important that at no time did Comcast ever fess up to its discrimination and say, you know what, we think the discrimination, I think this touches on your question, Judge Kavanaugh, we think the discrimination was pro-competitive.
Can we go back a moment? Commission finds discrimination, and I take it for there to be discrimination, it must be the case that there is not a non-affiliation-based, business purpose for what they do, right?
That's correct, that the
that
discrimination
fair?
Only applies if the discrimination is on the basis of affiliation.
All right, now we understand that under the contract, at least that part of the contract that the commission does not change, Comcast will have to pay a large sum of money, which I cannot mention, for as a consequence of the change that Tennis Channel proposes, right?
It's not clear because of this, Your Honor. The remedy gives Comcast discretion to comply in a number of ways, one of which would be to elevate Tennis Channel to the same tier as its own affiliate. It could comply in a different way.
But either way, at least as I understood the briefs, Comcast ends up paying a very substantial sum of money.
Not more than it already pays if, for example, it complied in this way. It could comply, and I don't think they dispute, they have a response to this, which I can respond to itself. But they could comply by simply moving their own affiliates to the same tier, the sports tier that Tennis Channel is on. If they did that, they're undoubtedly...
No one's even inquired into what the financial impact of that would be.
It would be the same, Your Honor, because Tennis Channel is already on the sports tier. There's an agreement in place until, I think, 2019
You've lost me. How do we know what the impact on Comcast is of moving Golf & Versus to another tier?
We know in terms of the license fee change, I think that's what I understood Your Honor to be getting at, how much more would the license fees be if it complied with this order? And my point is only that Tennis Channel could comply in a way that doesn't bump up the amount of license fees it owes.
Paid if, Tennis Channel.
Correct.
Right.
Correct.
But you haven't examined the impact, the financial impact on Comcast of this alternative equalization
device.
I think the order doesn't. Why don't we stick with the sort of obvious one of giving Tennis Channel the advantage enjoyed by Golf and Versus? And it's a substantial sum of money, and I guess I didn't see anything in the record indicating a dollar evidence that there would be a dollar enhancement, much less the equivalent of these sums, to Comcast from doing so.
Well, it's based on a per subscriber fee.
Right.
There is a formula in the
right.
contract they agreed upon.
Right.
The commission did
agreed
not
upon
specify.
Under the understanding that Comcast had discretion.
Well, I think taking discretion subject to federal law, there is a background presumption that I believe applies to any contract, which is when you enter into a contract, you take it subject to any laws in effect.
Let's just stick with the financial impact. Does the record have affirmative evidence that Comcast would enhance its revenue by so much as a dollar from making the either of the shifts which go directly to the benefit of Tennis Channel as opposed to indirectly through being hard on Golf and Versus?
I think in this way. The evidence shows, I believe this is in paragraph 77 of the order and 77 and 78 of the ALJ's decision, that I cannot list the amounts, but the Tennis Channel is much, much less expensive if you even evaluate it on a per ratings point cost. How many cents does it cost me to get one Nielsen ratings point? And if you do the metric and you compare the cost per ratings point of Tennis Channel, and if you compare that with the cost of the Comcast affiliates, Tennis Channel comes out much cheaper by orders of magnitude, and that's set forth in the order. So I think to the extent that they said...
Paragraph 77?
I believe so, Your Honor, and 77 and 78 of the ALJ decision. So I think that clearly shows, you know, they are interested in ratings. There was evidence from one of their witnesses that they are. Taking that into account, and this dovetails with my point to Judge Kavanaugh, at no time did they try to make the case that their discrimination was pro-competitive.
I'm looking at paragraph 77. I don't see anything corresponding to what you're saying.
Sorry, don't let me.
You fault Comcast for
I'm sorry, I
analyze it, but I take it no expert can
sorry,
forward.
Sorry, it's 78 of the commission decision. My apologies.
I'm sorry?
And it's in the bold type, 78, the following paragraph.
Ah.
So you see there, and these are confidential numbers, so I won't recite them, but you can see there is a very significant discrepancy in the amounts of cost. If you drop down to footnote 243, Your Honor, you see the variance in cost per ratings point, and this is spelled out in a bit more detail in the ALJ opinion, and I think the ALJ opinion, it comes up again in paragraph 77 and 78. But on the pro-competitive point, we don't take the position, Your Honors, that all favoring of affiliates, all vertical integration is in and of itself always anti-competitive. And the Commission recognized this in the Comcast...
The problem here, as I see it, just coming at this, is unreasonable restraint. Congress was presumably cognizant of the tradition in our country that vertical integration is pro-competitive unless there's market power, you know, usually pro-competitive unless there's market power for one of the entities.
Well, I have a twofold response to that. The first point, Judge Kavanaugh, is, of course, Comcast never made any argument in this case that the discrimination was pro-competitive.
No, but their legal theory on unreasonable restraint is that Congress had in mind basic competition law principles. Let's put aside the First Amendment for now, but just in terms of unreasonable.
True, and I think we go through at length in the brief why we think market power is not a requirement under the statute, either textually or as a First Amendment matter. But even if
if vertical integration is pro-competitive ordinarily, what sense does it make to think that Congress would want to deem unreasonable something that is beneficial to competition and consumer welfare?
I don't think it's the case that it ordinarily is absent market power. I think it may or may not be, and it depends on the case, and the entity regulated has to make a case. For example, this enhances efficiencies, this reduces transaction costs, this eliminates double marginalization, and they never made those arguments here. Now, on the market power point, even if the court would...
I'm sorry. What exactly is your basis for putting the burden on the regulated entity when we are talking within at least a backdrop of the First Amendment?
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, I think it is certainly the case that under 405 of the Communications Act, when the Commission is sitting as adjudicator, it's perfectly reasonable to expect that parties make their arguments and preserve the arguments. I don't think...
The Commission starts its opinion here by saying... It's not sure, but it will assume that the burden is on it to show a violation.
Well, it is true. I mean, I think this could be in the nature of one way of looking at it as sort of an affirmative defense, which is entirely reasonable to place on the defendant. I mean, there was no doubt the Commission placed the burden.
You make an affirmative defense by assuming the legitimacy of an interpretation which waters down. Well, I shouldn't say waters down, because that assumes some benchmark, but at least is markedly short of anything remotely comparable to ordinary competition principles.
If perhaps I could go to my primary point is the statute doesn't require market power. I would note, however, that although the Commission made no market power finding, and we concede that, it certainly said things that come quite close, and I believe there was evidence in the record that would support a showing of market power in the market for national advertisers. What you had was evidence that Comcast kept tennis...
That wasn't the theory the Commission adopted, so I don't know that that's really gets you very far here.
You know, courts have said Chenery isn't a ping-pong game between the courts and agencies. I think it's sort of close enough. And
is there any evidence, though, that Congress uses the phrase unreasonable restraint? Any evidence that Congress or... committees thought we're departing from competition law principles and giving the FCC some broader substantive authority?
Yes. In the House report at pages 42 and 43, the committee rejects what it refers to as traditional antitrust analysis, including the Herfindahl-Hirschman Index, which is a respected
antitrust measure. Right, sure. That's in talking about in some of the committee reports and some of the language talks about, as a general proposition, this act is not mere in all senses antitrust law.
I think, though, there, Your Honor, if you do read that passage, pages 42 and 43, carefully, you will see it starts off talking about the horizontal and vertical limits, and then it loops back quite explicitly to this anti-discrimination provision. So I believe that discussion is actually talking about this provision as well. But that would be...
Go ahead. Can you tell me, just before you sit down, what did Tennis learn in 2009 that they didn't know within a year after they signed the contract?
I believe towards the very end of 2008, they had made a number of improvements, including getting rights to the U.S. Open. Before that, getting the ability to televise in HD, which is obviously of increasing value to viewers. So toward the end of 2008, Tennis Channel was a very different network than it was.
You're saying that they felt their own self-assessment, based on their own self-assessment, they were a better operation. But they knew in 2005 that they might be a better operation.
No, because...
During the course of the contract, right?
I would disagree with that respectfully, Your Honor.
What business goes into business not hoping that they'll get better?
Well, they may hope they'll get better.
Well, when you're negotiating a contract, what I'm asking you is... I don't understand what they knew that was different other than the reality of their having grown, but they knew they were aiming to grow and hope to grow. And if you really want to protect with respect to that contingency, you write a provision that says in the event that we become X, we can insist on Y, right?
I think the difference is this. if they had said, we would like to grow, we hope we will grow, but they nonetheless filed suit before they actually had grown, that would have been dismissed as premature because they weren't in a position. Your Honor,
well,
the whole...
the language of your provisions just does not contemplate...
Well, Your Honor, can
I... The contract becomes silly. It has no meaning. Comcast has rights under the contract that are either respected by the agency or not, and you can't turn that on its head.
Well, I think the rights stem from the similarly situated analysis. In order to have a viable claim under the Commission's framework, they have to be in a position where they say, you know what, we are strong enough, we are similarly situated enough in terms of ratings, in terms of the other metrics, that we justify equal carriage. And they simply did not justify equal carriage earlier on. So that's why they couldn't, I would answer you, Judge Edwards, they couldn't have sued earlier on because that wasn't the reality.
Well, no, it isn't pursue. It's they could have written a different contract to give themselves an out to avoid the statute of limitations.
That does go back to my waiver point. And if Your Honors look at footnote 116 in the order, the Commission addresses this. At no time did Comcast make the argument that that contractual provision waives a right under this statute. They never made the argument, and the Commission therefore didn't address
it. Does it nullify the Commission's statute of limitations requirements?
No, I agree with that.
Can I ask on the First Amendment issue, because even if we, if you're correct that unreasonably restrained is ambiguous in terms of whether it incorporated competition law principles, there's the First Amendment backdrop, and it seems to me you have a serious problem with the First Amendment here, because this, without the market power requirement that seemed to be the predicate for Turner Broadcasting and the subsequent cases, I'm not sure.
Your Honor,
you've seen what I've written on this, so you know where I'm coming from.
I know where you're coming
from. That's my question.
Sure. Here's my answer. Yeah. Even if you read Turner, as I believe you do, to basically say you needed bottleneck power to sustain must carry, I believe, now I don't read Turner the same way, but even if you, Your Honor, do, I don't believe it follows that any carriage requirement similarly must satisfy bottleneck power for one reason, for example. Must carry is a broad structural rule that regulates cable operators. It looks at the market from a bird's eye perspective. It looks at incentives in general. 616 is a case-by-case provision. It applies in adjudications. You need, I think as the Commission explained in the order, there is an anti-competitive requirement that's built into the statute. So when you have a case-by-case provision like this, I believe Judge Ginsburg sort of distinguished in the Time Warner case from 2000, he distinguished structural and sort of prophylactic rules from what he called this provision, which is a behavioral norm. When you have a provision like this and you have specific factual findings, I don't think there is any suggestion in the Turner cases that you would need bottleneck in addition to that. And in fact, I believe Turner 2 kind of cuts the other way, because what it said there was the government could rely on the diversity interest regardless of whether the conduct rises to the level of an antitrust violation. It cites NBC against United States, which again reaffirmed that the Commission, in exercising its jurisdiction, and in NBC, what you had were exclusivity agreements.
The problem with that is, where's the cutoff then? Mr. Estrada referred to examples of the New York Times, and I've asked this before, but things like bookstores and newsstands. Well, if there's not a requirement of market power, why can't the government kind of get involved in bookstores, newsstands,
I understand the question.
That's my concern about going outside the market.
It's a very
power.
Valid concern, and the answer, I think, turns on the differences that are unique to the medium. If you consider, as of 2010, I think, most households had access, in theory at least, to up to 3 MVPDs, the local cable company or the 2 DBS providers. Now, actually, as a reality, I think it's fewer than that, because for many people, you know, they live in an apartment, they're not able to install a satellite.
Your initial statement that you then said was not quite accurate was that most.
Yes, I believe it's two-thirds.
Only means 51%.
No, I think it was two-thirds as of 2010, which is the relevant period here.
Right. In other words, not all. Most,
no,
yes,
correct.
But not all.
Correct, not all, but most. Compare that with newspapers. I believe there are something like 1,300 daily newspapers in the United States. So I think that's
but in a lot of localities, there's one major newspaper in that locality.
One plus, I would say, a plethora of others that are available. both in print and online. There are also very different barriers to entry, I think, Judge Kavanaugh. So, for example, it is not outside the realm of the possible for someone to say, I'm going to start my own desktop publishing business, I'm going to publish a pamphlet, I'm going to publish a small newspaper. That's very different, I would submit, from saying I'm going to launch a satellite or I'm going to lay fiber in the ground and start my own cable system. Mm-hmm. So I think there are very significant differences, and this kind of loops back to what Justice Kennedy said in the Turner case when talking about gatekeeper power of cable. Mm-hmm. Now, even if you take the position, Your Honor, that at that time cable essentially had a national stranglehold, you know, bottleneck sort of meaning exclusive or near exclusive control, and even conceding that in general cable doesn't have near exclusive or actual exclusive national control, I think the gatekeeper issue still exists, particularly in light of what this court said only just about a year ago in the Cablevision case when it talked about the mixed picture in the market. It talked about...
That was an as-applied challenge in specific areas. Or
that's true, but in a sense, that does sort of loop into this framework, which is the 616 sort of mechanism as distinct from the sort of more structural rules. But
I guess I would conclude my questions by this, which is on unreasonably restraints, on the First Amendment, I guess we could debate, but I think there's at least a serious question, in my view, constitutional question there. So why confront the constitutional question when the Supreme Court has told us many times to interpret statutes?
Your Honors, I would ask this of the Court. If the Court rejects our argument, we made a series of textual arguments and First Amendment arguments, that market power is not required under this statute, I would ask the Court to at least give the Commission the opportunity to show that there was market power here. And my point on
before we get to that, and I take your point on
yes.
that, I hear you, but why wouldn't constitutional avoidance be the way to interpret this statute? We clearly have a serious question.
Because I think that would really quite drastically skew the meaning of the statute.
Well, unreasonably restrains, under your theory, as I understand it,
does not require market
power. It's ambiguous. So if it's ambiguous and there's a serious constitutional question, why trigger?
I mean, I guess my answer would be, given the legislative history so clear, given all the other indicia we point to in our brief against.
I mean, so clear?
I would point to those provisions of the House report.
Yeah.
And I think the Supreme Court has said, in a case called Humanitarian Law Project against Holder, that you know there are limits to constitutional avoidance, and you really shouldn't
They've
run.
They've used it a lot, and recently
they use it, but I think in that case they said you shouldn't run counter to the purpose of the statute, and I think it would here. But if I could just make the final closing point, I believe there is enough in the record to show market power here in the market for advertisers. There was expert testimony that by basically suppressing Tennis Channel below the 40 million threshold, Comcast could raise its own advertising prices, and I can give Your Honors a cite for that. That's at 1083 of the Joint Appendix. It was testimony from competition expert Dr. Hal Singer. Of course, as you know, Your Honors, the ability to raise price through restricting output is the very definition of market power. So I believe the Commission could conclude that.
Let me just ask, I focused on your paragraph 78, since you called my attention to it, and these comparative costs of carrying the channel in relation to rating points, is that net or gross? When I say net, I mean net of what Comcast gains by virtue of being an owner of Gulf and Versus.
I think it's gross, Your Honor. I think that when
okay.
it was looking at
okay.
subscribers.
So then I want to ask, in terms of the Commission's view of discrimination, is the Commission an MVPD barred from taking into account whether it's going to get some of the revenue that it normally pays out to the channel back?
I don't think so if it does a genuine cost-benefit analysis, and that was what was lacking here. So if it said net it is far better for us to carry Golf Channel and the Versus at the broader level of penetration, because on a net basis, we make more money by doing that. We would be losing money by carrying Tennis Channel if it could substantiate it. It actually had weighed the costs and the benefits, which, of course, the record does not show here. Then I believe that would be a successful defense to discrimination.
Then you're telling me that the record does not have these net figures and anything equivalent of paragraph 78 in terms of nets.
I think that sort of goes to my they never made a pro-competitive argument. They never put in any evidence to suggest that when you consider other indirect impacts on their own networks, they would be losing money in another way, so that the gross number actually isn't a fair reflection of the cost benefit. I don't believe they disputed these numbers.
Well, the gross number, I mean, obviously wouldn't be a
well, again, I don't think, you know, I don't think the commission
benefit.
You know, I think that they made the defense of a cost benefit analysis. I think it was incumbent upon them to put in numbers that showed it. And in fact, they didn't. They conceded. The executive who did the analysis conceded she didn't consider any benefits.
Yeah, you characterize it as a defense. I guess I'm not sure under what that there's a valid baseline vision of affiliation-based discrimination that answers that question, answers the classification question.
I think it would be quite similar. I mean, Congress, this is clear in the legislative history, did ask the commission to look to the body of discrimination law in general, and I think this is very much a classic. I mean, I'm not talking necessarily about the McDonnell-Douglas burden-shifting standard, but what I am talking about is a classic case where someone says, you discriminated against me for an impermissible reason, and the employer comes back and says, no, I did it, you know, for a justified reason based on qualifications or whatever else. So I think it fits that framework quite aptly. If there are no further questions, I would just ask if the court gets into market power, that it keep in mind, I believe that the commission could make the case on market power. This is the market power with respect to advertisers. I pointed the court to the expert testimony on this issue. There is also a relevant passage in the Comcast-NBC merger order that is cited in this order multiple times, and this is at JA page 794, in which the commission said, by making rivals less attractive to advertisers through diminished audience, which is what you have here, Comcast affiliates are able to, quote, obtain, or to the extent they may already possess it, maintain market power with respect to advertisers seeking access to their viewers. This is a JA 794. It's part of the Comcast-NBC merger order. And I think, again, it would support the commission would be fully in a position, I think, to make a finding of market power with respect to national advertisers if the court rejects our primary argument that market power is actually not part of this statute. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Long?
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court, Robert Long representing the Tennis Channel. Judge Edwards, on the timeliness question, I think this is like if someone signed an employment contract and it was a term of the contract that whether I get promoted is going to be in the discretion of the employer, and there was a one-year statute of limitations on the employment contract, and then several years later, the person went and said, you know, my performance has been excellent, I've done very well. And just to make this a simple hypothetical, if the employer said, well, yeah, but I'm not going to promote you because you're a woman, that would be, I mean, it's not really a claim. There would be a claim under the anti-discrimination laws, not for breach of contract, but for failure to abide by the anti-discrimination law. And if you didn't allow such a claim, it would be absurd because you'd simply wait.
What the commission has said, I'm reading it again, because I'm really startled by the arguments. I don't know how we are where we are, given what the commission said. And I just read again what they've said. They said, if it's about the existing contract, it's barred unless you meet it within 1 year. The hypothetical you give has to do with the effects of external law. The law here is the commission's within the compass of the commission's province and their regulation, and what does their regulation mean? They have already construed this regulation in a way that's contrary to what you just asserted. Well, they made that construction. They reinforced it in 99. They said nothing to the contrary, and they came up with a weird laches addendum now, which they never before have said. I mean, the language in this 1990 thing is powerfully against what you said, which reinforces what they originally said.
Well, but I listened carefully, and it said, you know, an offer to amend the contract does not reopen the one-year period. This was not an offer to amend a contract. It was a statement that, you know, you would be discriminating against.
What the commission says was anything having to do with the obligations under that original contract are closed after a year. This was nothing that Tennis couldn't have anticipated in writing that contract. So that's where your hypothetical fails.
Well, I mean, I know you'll look at this very carefully, and I think with the later statements and this, you know, huge loophole that would open, that, you know, this is really, it would not be reasonable to interpret it that broadly. That,
well, then why did the commission do it that way? I mean, that's what they did. They haven't amended what they originally did. And the commission itself has essentially conceded that by saying, oh, that was changed 18 years ago. It wasn't changed 18 years ago.
Well, the language of the rule was changed.
But the rule was never intended to have a different effect. They did it to allow allow all to file complaints. That's all.
Well, and there is,
it was
and
not intended to affect the meaning of three. And they made that very clear.
Well, there's also the point that the Media Bureau decisions, they're acting with full delegated authority from the commission, so there really was no problem of unfair notice to Comcast.
Did the commission write this in its opinion and say, we really meant to embrace the media's reinterpretation? You still got a notice issue, but in any event, did they say that in their decision here?
In this decision?
Yeah.
I mean, they said that we interpret the rule as not to create this loophole that we're just discussing, that you can wait a year and a day.
Well, what I'm saying is that they say that we meant to change the law, and the media division did, and we embraced that. I mean, I'm not getting it. There's a way we do things in administrative law. This isn't the way we do it.
All right. Well, I think I've given you my best
argument. You've given me your shot.
Let me move on to another. I think Judge Kavanaugh's main question is, look, unless we can show there's actual market power here, vertical integration can't be a problem, and therefore any sort of restriction based on competitive concerns really can't be valid, and there would be a First Amendment issue if we went any distance with that. And I would urge you, to look at the actual, first of all, the facts in this case. We have an adjudicated case where Comcast had every opportunity and every incentive to explain, you know, what were the pro-competitive reasons for keeping Tennis Channel at a low level. And what they came up with, they said, oh, well, we did a cost-benefit analysis. And the finding of the commission, which has to be accepted, is that they didn't do a cost-benefit analysis. They didn't even look into the benefits. And they said, well, there wasn't any interest in the Comcast systems in carrying Tennis Channel more broadly. And the finding, again, in this case, was that that was a litigation ploy. It wasn't a legitimate inquiry. So that is, first of all, suspicious. I mean, if your intuition is right, that there really can't be a problem here. In this situation, Comcast should have had.
But isn't their legal theory on the first issue that they're allowed to say, we want to promote our speech, not to be forced to promote by the government someone else's speech?
And I think, yes, I heard counsel for Comcast say that, you know, I make no bones about it. My theory is we can drop all the unaffiliated stations tomorrow. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that is a breathtaking theory. I mean, Comcast agreed.
Why is it without market power? That's what I keep coming back to. Why is it different from a newspaper?
And again, I mean,
we would never tell a newspaper. The government, I don't think, would tell a newspaper.
Tell it if it did have market power.
Yes. Right. That goes to a different point.
This is very different. I mean, here we have both Congress and the FCC saying we think there are problems here. There's a possibility of exercising market power. I mean, in paragraph 87 of this order, the commission said, as we found in a previous proceeding, Comcast's extensive cable distribution network affords it the ability to use its market position to harm other competing video programming firms and harm competition in video programming. So it's a finding, and that is not, you know, so outside the mainstream of economic
reasoning.
Is harm
defined for purposes of that sentence?
I'm sorry, Judge.
Is the word harm defined for purposes of that sentence?
Is the word harm?
Harm, right. Because in all these hypotheticals, presumably the channel seeking to be carried would prefer to be carried, and it would prefer to be carried because it would make more money, and so deprivation of that, quote, harms it. But that's ubiquitous, right?
Well, but you know, there are very respectable economists. Some of these are cited in the order. Some of them are cited in the Comcast NBC order that's cross-cited in this order. Reardon and Salop, David Waterman, Hausinger, the expert in this case. I commend to you all of their writing, and basically they say, look, a foreclosure strategy can make sense if you have the ability to really raise the costs. And here that happens because the costs of the programming for Tennis Channel are fixed. So if you can hold down their subscribers by 24%, that greatly increases their cost per subscriber. And because there's, again, we're talking about facts found in this proceeding, there's a ripple effect. That language comes from Comcast. Their own executives think this exists, and they have made, you know, we won't go into what's in, under seal, but there's evidence in the record that in their business they act on this belief that it exists. So they effectively, it's like they have more than 24%. So when you have that kind of a market structure where you can raise your rivals' costs significantly, and where you also, this is a dynamic market where you potentially have winner-take-all outcomes. We know that Versus is competing with Tennis Channel for the very same programs, for the U.S. Open and Wimbledon and other programs. And so, you know, this kind of a strategy, economists believe, can make sense. You know, forego some revenue in the short run in order to harm a competitor and come out ahead in the long run. So I don't think, Judge Kavanaugh, it would be appropriate with all of these factual findings by the FCC, the expert agency, and with Congress's clear concern about this to say this is sort of something that can't happen in antitrust law.
Just like, a second, to go back. As you formulated that, you spoke of foregoing revenue in the short run, and that appeared to be sort of the substratum of your there is discrimination argument, which would seem to me to move it into the part to be shown by the commission.
Right. I mean, on discrimination, we think there's overwhelming evidence of discrimination.
Well, it seems to me it's an attractive formulation that you offer. We have a case where there's a short run foregoing of revenue. And therefore you explain it in terms of a long-run competitive advantage.
Mm-hmm.
But that very framing of it suggests that showing the short-run deprivation of revenue is part of the case for discrimination, case for showing that discrimination occurred.
With respect, Judge, I don't agree. I mean, I think if Congress felt there was a problem here and if the FCC thinks there's a problem, having a case-by-case analysis, so this is not a prophylactic rule, like many of the rules that this court has reviewed and upheld under this 92 Cable Act, simply saying, all right, if Tennis Channel thinks it's being discriminated against on the basis of ownership and it's being unreasonably restrained, come in and prove it. And then if Comcast comes up with these explanations that we have findings of fact were not credible and litigation ploys, I don't think as a constitutional matter or even as well, you know, serious constitutional problems at that point, the FCC and Congress are powerless to say, look, at that stage, we're going to say stop discriminating. There certainly can be a problem.
Now, it seems to me you've moved to a definition of discrimination, which is simply a showing of a raw difference, and I mean really raw difference, in treatment between affiliated and non-affiliated channels.
Well, I mean, as I understand...
It's somewhat different from the one you articulated in the earlier colloquy with me.
Well, I hope not. I mean, I was trying to explain why there could actually be, could actually be market power in the first instance, or there could be a sort of leveraging, special conditions of this market could allow, very plausibly, allow Comcast to effectively exercise market power with, smaller market shares than would usually happen. But an additional argument, and I don't see it as contradictory at all, is to say when we're in this situation, it is open to Congress and it's open to the FCC to have a case-by-case adjudication rule. I mean, for example, mergers, as you know, arrest...
A case-by-case adjudication rule, as you know, does not wave aside the question for finding principles that will govern the cases, right?
Well, but what I'm suggesting, and I think this is the way the FCC has done it, is the case-by-case adjudication would be, one, did you discriminate? Was it on the basis of ownership? And then, were you unreasonably restraining the ability of this unaffiliated network to compete? And I submit that as a constitutional matter, when you have this general background, that look, it is plausible that there would be anti-competitive strategies and anti-competitive action here. In the merger order, in the NBC Comcast merger order, there was a study by Austin Goolsbee, and he found, not only does Comcast favor its own networks, but it does so for anti-competitive reasons. He said, look, where they face more competition in markets where they have a smaller market share for their cable system, they carry Tennis Channel and other channels more broadly, and that's an indication that they're making these carriage decisions for anti-competitive reasons. So when you have all of that evidence, I mean, we really have quite a record here to simply say, well, I mean, it's like, there was a famous geographer who, when the eyewitness reports came back that there was snow on Kilimanjaro, said, well, that's impossible. There can't be snow it's on the equator. That, is a matter of theory that can't exist. And, ultimately, we have a lot of eyewitness facts here that there are some problems. Comcast can't explain this. We have studies like the Goolsbee study suggesting not only do they discriminate, but the explanation seems to be anti-competitive, not one, some of the possibly pro-competitive explanations you were exploring. So with all of those facts in the record, I think, the statute clearly is open to be interpreted the way the FCC interprets it if you set aside the First Amendment. And I just don't think there is a serious First Amendment problem.
Not even a serious question?
Well, but Judge Kavanaugh, I mean,
test, right?
When newspapers want to merge, mm-hmm. Of course, they've got a special, I guess that's a bad example. When television stations want to merge, they don't have a First Amendment argument that, look, the Clayton Act, Section 7, is designed to arrest competitive problems in their incipiency before they happen. They don't have an argument that, well, we're engaged in speech, so that you should have to show more. And I submit this is a version of that. They're identifying a problem that they see. I mean, I actually think it's beyond its incipiency here. I mean, I think this is a real problem. There's evidence of it. But even if it were a little short of that, there's no constitutional impediment to the Congress or the FCC addressing that, and to say, well,
But I guess what I'm concerned about, and I'm probably repeating myself, but if we accept this theory of the First Amendment, and it's divorced from the bottleneck hook that was key in Turner, then it seems we have a First Amendment theory that we've ushered in that opens the door for the government to force non-market power participants in the speech market to carry speech they don't like, and that seems very contrary to our traditions.
Not at all, and I would not urge...
So how would I distinguish, then, a newspaper from non-market?
I would write this quite narrowly based on the facts of this case and the...
I mean, it's almost as if you're saying Comcast really does have market power. I mean,
well, that would be one way to write it, and as I agree with the FCC, there's plenty of evidence in here that they actually do. Another way that I'm suggesting is to look at the economic literature, including a lot that's quoted or cited in paragraph 87 of this order, paragraph 116 of the Comcast NBC order, the Hal Singer testimony, the Tennis Channel economist, starting at 1078 of the joint appendix, and say, you know, there are economic theories. They would not be adopted by Judge Bork, but they are adopted by a number of reputable economists. A majority of the FTC not too long ago thought there was a serious antitrust problem of vertical foreclosure with the proposed merger of, I think it was Time Warner and Turner. So, you know, this is... You can't say as a court that this is a non-starter sort of economic theory, and then say if we're in that world, Congress has some leeway under the First Amendment, and so does the FCC to say, look, we're not going to have a prophylactic rule saying you always have to treat unaffiliated networks equally, but we are going to have a case-by-case rule, and if somebody thinks, one, they're being discriminated against on the basis of ownership, and two, they're being unreasonably restrained in their ability to compete fairly, that they can come to the FCC and prove it. And that should be sufficient to then require non-discrimination, not necessarily carriage or improved carriage, just non-discrimination. And I think really that's not a big stretch. It's a matter of First Amendment law. And you know, what the Supreme Court said the second time in Turner, after remanding, they ended up saying, that we have to give a lot of deference to Congress, even in the First Amendment area, you know, when it involves disputed predictions about economic matters. I suppose that raises the question of why they remanded the case. But anyway, I mean, that's the law.
A lot of people had that question.
I was a junior lawyer at the time, and that was we all wondered that. But but anyway, I mean, that's the law. And, you know, given that I don't think it's really possible or appropriate to say there can't be any competitive problem here, no economist, no reputable economist would ever say there was, I think this is an area where there is room for predictive judgments of Congress and the FCC.
Thank you, Mr. Long. Mr. Estrada, give you a few minutes.
Yeah, let me just start with the question that Judge Williams raised. There is no evidence in this record that Congress would have made a dime. There is plenty of evidence, which I think is in the Gaisky and in the Bond testimony in the appendix. I can give you the pages. I would go to Bond 296 and following, and Gaisky, I think, 401 in the joint appendix and following. There's also her prepared testimony at 481 and following. And the sum of it is this. Carriage of Tennis Channel, even at a discounter offer price in 2009, in a discount I can't mention, would have lost Comcast a ton of money over the term of the contract, and the figures are specified there. It is also specified that the field was pulled and no one expressed any interest or had any view that this would drive subscribership for Comcast if this were put in a broader tier. And so it is just false to say that the benefits were not considered. The benefits were non-existent. Now, the counsel for the agency mentioned this notion of advertising. And if you look at the bottom of page 38 of our blue brief, we have all of the JA sites as to why that does not carry the day. I would commend to you especially JA 545 to 546. which is the testimony of the Economist, who points out that cable companies thrive on subscribership, not advertising. What matters to our clients largely is this a good that will cause somebody to subscribe to my service? You know, the advertising is relevant, but less so. And on that point, I finally will turn you to the Bond testimony on the question of advertising and how it impacts this question, which I believe starts at J296. I see my time has expired. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. The case is submitted. Thank you for excellent arguments by all three attorneys.